McKinleyville.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I have to recuse myself. I sit on the McKinleyville Community Services District Board, and I will be leaving the room.
Okay. And
Mr. Charles Reed will give the staff report on McKinleyville.
And if I may, I'll read the opening statement. This is the time and place for a hearing by the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, North Coast Region, to consider proposed waste discharge requirement order number R1-2008-0039 for McKinleyville Community Services District Wastewater Management Facility. This item has been properly noticed. Sheet explaining procedures for this hearing is available at the handout table. Will all those who expect to give testimony in this matter please stand? Raise your right hand and take the following oath. Do you swear or affirm that you will tell the truth in this matter? At this time, we'll start with staff presentation. Mr. Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Give me a moment to get situated here. My name is Charles Reed. I'm a staff engineer with the Water Board. I'd like to file into the record. Item number 9 is the public hearing to consider waste discharge requirements. Order number R1-2008-0039 for the McKinleyville Community Services District Wastewater Management Facility. This permit will serve as an NPDES permit for the next 5 years. I might point out in the slide that this is a view eastward from the ocean to the McKinleyville treatment plant. You can see the Mad River estuary in the foreground and the treatment plant in the rear. Today I'll be covering the following points in my presentation. I'll be describing the facility setting and the wastewater treatment and disposal systems, recent enforcement actions, key permit conditions, and some requests and comments that the discharger made in response to the draft permit, and I'll also introduce some late permit revisions. City of McKinleyville is located in Humboldt County, approximately 230 miles north of Santa Rosa and about 6 miles north of the city of Arcata, McKinleyville up here. The wastewater treatment facility is a U.S. EPA major discharger with a rated dry weather capacity of 1.61 million gallons per day. Actual dry weather flow is on the order of 850,000 gallons per day. The CSD provides sewer service to approximately 9,000 residents in the unincorporated town of McKinleyville. Wastewater treatment consists of aerated wastewater stabilization ponds. You can see that here in 1A, 1B, 2, and 3. And that treatment is followed by treatment in these wastewater treatment wetlands. And this system will meet equivalent to secondary treatment standards. And final effluent is disinfected in this location prior to final discharge. In addition to the locations that I'll be describing in the next slide, this permit also authorizes discharge of treated wastewater to maintain vegetation during the summer in the Hiller Stormwater Treatment Wetlands, which was constructed recently to treat wastewater from the from McKinleyville. The inflow and the outflow from this stormwater treatment wetlands will be monitored to ensure that wastewater is not discharged to surface water. That is wastewater that's been used to keep the wetlands moist. From October 1st to May 14th, the McKinleyville is authorized to discharge waste, treated wastewater to the Mad River, which flows along here and out to the ocean here. The Mad River West Estuary is located in this location and extends all the way back to this bridge, conveniently just downstream of the discharge point. When flows in the Mad River are less than 200 cubic feet per second, the discharger is allowed to discharge treated wastewater to this percolation ponds here, which are located adjacent to the Mad River estuary. And this is an important fact because if these percolation ponds are hydrologically connected to the estuary, we may have a problem with our prohibition for discharges to estuaries. I'll talk about that real briefly later in a following slide. During the summer from May 15th to September 30th, or when weather conditions allow, treated wastewater is also recycled at the Upper Fisher Ranch, the Lower Fisher Ranch, and the Pyalorsi Ranch. I've included some pictures on the right up here. These pictures were taken in March of this year, and you can see that the Lower Fisher Ranch in this area here tends to hold water. It doesn't percolate well. And between the lower and the upper ranch, right in this area, there is a water feature that has been identified in this permit as a backswamp wetland. I'm not exactly sure where that term came from, but I kept it in the permit. And this is we consider waters of the state, and it terminates into the slide gate, which is going to be monitored for wastewater constituents to ensure that the wastewater irrigated on the upper and lower Fisher Ranches don't make it to this water feature and ultimately out to the Mad River estuary. The McKinleyville CSD was a subject of Administrative Civil Liability Order number R1-2007-0018. Adopted by the Regional Board on April 26, 2007. The Board assessed a mandatory minimum penalty of $231,000 for 92 effluent violations that occurred from January 2000 through May 2005. The District submitted a proposal for the completion of a compliance project in lieu of payment of $221,000 of that fine. The project was accepted and the wetlands construction was completed in November 2005, but full treatment effectiveness of the wetlands is not anticipated until January 2009. Photos of the wetlands showing various degrees of success in establishing persistent vegetation in the wetland cells in the pictures here on the right. Pond 4 shows kind of sparse vegetation. They've had some difficulty getting the vegetation to hold there. Pond 5, which follows Pond 4, has quite a bit more vegetation you can see here, except for a ring around this side. It's almost completely vegetated. Despite the fact that Pond 4 is not completely vegetated here, the effluent quality and the permit compliance has been improving significantly since the completion of this project in November 2005. And the next slide, I was has a bit perhaps too much information on it, but I thought it was a good idea to add it to show the trend in treatment and effluent quality that we've seen since November. Or since January 2006, really. You can see since suspended solids as a weekly average markedly declining since 2001. BOD has been improving slightly, but not nearly as dramatically as suspended solids as a weekly average and as a monthly average. Suspended solids effluent concentrations have decreased from 89 milligrams per liter roughly to about 41 milligrams per liter since 2006. In this last discharge season, 2007-2008, we've seen BOD and suspended solid concentrations at about 30 milligrams per liter, which is a dramatic improvement from compared to 2000 to 2005. The proposed order contains some significant changes from the previous permit. The new permit establishes final effluent limitations for CTR pollutants that have shown reasonable potential to cause or contribute to an exceedance of a water quality criterion. Because the discharger has adequately demonstrated that it cannot immediately achieve the final limits for these constituents, interim limits and a compliance schedule to achieve final limits have been included in the permit. The compliance schedule is aggressive and focuses on public education and source control to bring the discharge into compliance by May 2010. The new permit also includes new monitoring requirements of the discharge for nutrients, CTR pollutants, and other water quality parameters to assess compliance with effluent limitations and receiving water limitations and objectives. The permit also includes more thorough monitoring of the receiving water to document compliance with water quality objectives of the Mad River and local groundwater. The new permit requires a discharger to complete a water reclamation study to determine the feasibility of long-term compliance with Title 22 recycling criteria. And finally, the new permit requires a discharger to provide information to evaluate whether the discharge to the percolation pond complies with the basin plan's prohibition for discharges to estuaries, and if necessary, to discuss alternatives to this discharge. The discharger submitted comments on the draft permit on May 5th. The most significant comments were related to our initial discussion to reject the discharger's request for a compliance schedule to achieve final CTR limits, the discharger's request for a relaxation of the mass effluent limits for BOD and suspended solids based on the treatment facility's newly rated treatment capacity, and the discharger's request for a reduction in monitoring requirements. Regional Water Board staff addressed these requests at length in the staff's response to comments, which is included in your permit package, and I believe it's in pink. In short, the discharger submitted a revised compliance schedule that was deemed acceptable with some minor modifications, so we included the compliance schedule and interim limits in the permit. With respect to the mass effluent limits, the treatment facility capacity was re-rated recently from 1.18 MGD to 1.61 MGD. And the city requested a commensurate change in the mass effluent limitation, which is based on flow and concentration. This new mass limit would have, in effect, allowed for an additional discharge of mass to the Mad River. And we could not do this because this would introduce anti-backsliding and anti-degradation issues that we needed to address. So we did not grant this request. However, at any time during the permit, the discharger can provide us with information that we can do a full anti-degradation analysis and make whatever changes to the permit that are appropriate. We also reviewed the discharger's request for reduced monitoring. We removed monitoring requirements for CTR pollutants in the Hiller stormwater treatment wetland that were contained in the first draft permit. And we also reduced monitoring frequency for total trihalomethanes in the treated effluent. As a late revision, Regional Water Board staff included interim effluent limitations for CTR pollutants with reasonable potential. Interim limitations are required by the state implementation plan for toxic substance control when a compliance schedule exceeds 1 year in length. These interim limits were inadvertently not included in the draft permit, and we ask you to include these here. I believe it's you have a copy of the late revisions document.
I'll take it to the state. Okay.
And that will conclude my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have.
We have board member questions. I have one, Charles. In terms of the numbers, again, on the design flow, 1.61 was, what was the previous number? You gave two numbers. I missed the first
1.18 MGD. The mass limitation in the previous permit was based on that flow. You would take the concentration in the effluent limit times the design flow, 1.1 MGD at that time, and come up with a mass effluent limitation. In the interim period, the facility was re-rated to have a design capacity of 1.61 MGD. And we didn't. It brought up anti-backsliding and anti-degradation issues to automatically allow an additional mass to be discharged to the Mat River without some evaluation.
All right. Anyone else? Okay, we'll go on to comments from the discharger.
Good morning. My name is Tom Arfing, General Manager with McKinleyville CSD. First of all, I'd like to thank the board for the opportunity to respond to this new permit. I'd like to thank staff. We've worked with Mr. Dunbar for quite a number of years. I think I was around when he wrote that first 10-page NPDES permit, and I long for those days. Maybe it's appropriate that he's making his curtain call about the time we're brought into the 21st century, I guess, with this new permit. We find this permit extremely onerous. Maybe we've been living in a fairy tale world up there, but we find this thing incredibly expensive, and this is very, very difficult for us to meet. I'd like to thank first Al Wellman for all his work with us over the past 6 or 7 years, and Mr. Charles Reed now that's come on, and John Stewart. They've been very, I think, helpful wherever they can be. I understand they're in a situation they're required to write a permit with these constituents and these emissions limitations. Some of our concern for the permit is the time. I mean, Tom brought up a good thing that, they used to be 10 pages. This last permit was 108 pages of technical language. We had about 3 weeks to digest this thing and respond to it. It's got 6 studies that are hooked to it, so we know that this is just an opening of the door. This is the regulations will continue to get worse. They're going to be more stringent, and we're frankly we're overwhelmed with this permit. We actually don't know how we're going to meet the terms of this permit. Not to mention the financial cost of this thing. I've talked to a number of engineers, and they're telling me $50 million maybe at a low end. I don't know if that's that's affordable for us or not. That's certainly a shock to us to hear that. There's constituents in this permit that we don't think can be removed. I know Ferndale to the south of it is just spending $7.5 million on a 500 customers. We're going to spend $50 million on 4,500 services. I mean, the numbers get truly staggering when you start looking at the cost per gallon and the $80 to $100 cost per month of operating these things. I think it's a shock to our community, certainly. The change in this permit is so substantial that we really would have liked more than, more than 3 week period to respond, just to get engineers involved and to study this. And we burned a lot of midnight oil, and I burned 3 weekends just going through this permit over and over again, trying to understand the complexity of the permit, some of the language that was difficult to understand. There's some parts of it we still don't technically understand what it means. They really can't be explained to us. But it's language that came out of the National Toxics Rule. I know the staff has done the best they can, and we appreciate their cooperation. I think they're in a very tough situation also. Some of the specific areas of concern is, you know, we're going to have to test for groundwater. You know, mind you, we live in an area that has anywhere from 50 to 80 inches of rain a year. You know, we're now trying to figure out how to dispose of 1 million gallons of wastewater. We're restricted what times we can go in the river. We have limitations now. We can see coming down the road on agronomic uptake that we're looking at disposing of land right now on maybe 80 to 100 acres. It's going to be as much as 2,000 acres we're going to have available to dispose of just because of the rainfall income in our area. I mean, where are we going to store these tens of millions or 100 million gallons of water in high periods of rainfall before we can discharge either to land through irrigation or into a river, because we can only go there from not past May 15th, and it can rain clear into June there. Our rains can start very early. You know, in the start of our project a few years ago, it started raining October 5th and didn't stop for almost 6 weeks. That's when we first planted the marsh. You know, the perk basin impacts. If we lose the perk basins, impact of the estuary, that's another concern. You know, the nutrient balance, you know, the irrigation amounts for agronomic rates. This waters of the state, they showed you the lower ranch. What that is, those waters of the state originate from a 2-foot county storm drain that dumps water onto our property. And the county and the Caltrans does this all over that area. They just dump a 2 or 3 foot pipe on your property, and it's left yours to deal with. And those become waters of the state, you know, as they flow across our property. And so we're impacted by those. Those things are out of our control, and yet now we have to test and be responsible for them. We have a dairy operator that works that area historically, our ranch where we dispose of, been a ranch for almost 100 years. You know, we're right giving notice to the dairy operator now that, you know, we're going to virtually put him into bankruptcy. You know, we simply cannot have him on that land disposing of cattle waste, or just even have cattle grazing there because of the contamination of nitrates in the groundwater. I mean, we know before we came there, we studied that there was as much as 33 milligrams per liter in the groundwater just from the cattle operation. We have about 15 parts, you know, that we have to contend with. So we simply can't have him operating. So we've given him notice. And, you know, he's a gentleman that sunk his life savings into this about 3 or 4 years ago. He's got 5 kids, and he's faced with bankruptcy. You know, we're going to force, we think, small businesses in our community out of business into bankruptcy. You know, we accept all the septage from Humboldt County comes to our area, because there's Humboldt County's very rural areas, lots of septic tanks. Well, they have to take that somewhere, and they bring it to us. We're immediately going to have to go back and shut them down. And what they're going to do with all these people, I don't know, but we simply can't accept this stuff. We have the airport there. We have the county vet. They have all their dog pound. They have a brand new dog animal control clinic they built there 2 years ago. That every dog that comes in, they wash them with flea and tick soap. Well, that's got lindane in it. You know, we're going to have to tell them that has to all stop. We're going to have to make them test their waters. These tests are like $6,000 a piece. These are not inexpensive tests. The Coast Guard has a helicopter squadron in there that, you know, they wash all their helicopters while their lubricants go down. You know, we're going to have to shut them down and make them put in some kind of filtration system that we don't take their water. I mean, this is really extreme for us. This is not an easy permit for us to meet. And some of this we have to meet by August 1st. You know, I mean, less than two months away. The CTR requirements are going to hit us in, 23 months? You know, we have engineers telling us it's going to take a tertiary plant like this not even seen in California to deal with things like bisphthalate, dioxins, lindane. They can't be removed. You know, we're going to tell all the schools up there, you can't use lindane to treat head lice on children. Just one ounce, 1% solution of lindane will pollute 6 million gallons of water. 8 kids use that, and our plant now is in violation. How are we going to handle this stuff? You know, the economic impact, you know, we think it's going to be severe to us. You know, we have $32,000 a year as a median housing income up there. You know, we look at this, it costs $11,000 to $15,000 per service to do this. You know, over a long period of time, it will be as high as 30 with, you know, over a 30-year period of net present value of the dollar. The engineers are telling us you're probably going to be $80 to $100 a month in your service costs. You know, that's 6 to 7 times what we are now. You know, to remove copper, lead, bisphthalate, 4,4-DDT, cyclohexane, which is lindane, dioxins. You know, where do these things come from? I mean, we're a little community. You know, we're a bedroom community, and we have these things showing up. Maybe they're coming through the septic haulers. I was surprised that I have a friend of mine in the rest home there, and I was talking about that he used to be on the board. He comes out and gives me a bottle of Malathion. It's what doctors prescribed to him to wash their hair, and it's 0.5% Malathion. I thought they stopped making stuff 30 years ago. They still prescribe it. The doctors and the school nurses and the vets still use Lindan, and Malathion is the only successful treatment for head lice and scabies. Are we prepared to tell them you can't use this anymore? Because if those kids don't use it, they can't come to school. They're told if they don't use this, do not show up to school. So, I mean, we're a little bit amiss what we're going to do. We've already started a public education process, and we've put this information out, but these issues are of a big concern to us. We're looking at spending 25% of our operating budget this year just in increased testing. We've gone from 10,000 a year to 40,000 last year to 120,000 with this new permit just to monitor. We figure another 150,000 in the next 2 years just to study, just these increased studies. And we haven't fixed anything yet. That's just to study things. And now we're trying to figure out what we're going to do with all this 1 million gallons of sewage a day, treated wastewater. Where are we going to put this? We're going to be in violation if we go on the river. We're going to be in violation if we go on the ground. We're going to have to try to spread it out instead of 60 or 70 acres to 700 or 800 acres. And if we get caught in heavy rainfall periods, it may take up to 1,500 to 2,000 acres for us to release it. Where are we going to store this at? We can't convert agricultural land into storage basins. That's a conversion. I mean, this really puts us in a rock and a hard spot. And I mean, we have a very, very small amount of time in which to comply. And I guess, maybe it's appropriate where, we're being dragged into the 21st century, but I don't know, maybe we should have. There's only two things we can come up with, really, and I'm serious about this. We're looking at either ocean outfall or we go back to some kind of regional concept. I just don't understand how small communities like in the North Coast and Blue Lake's going to have it, we have it, Ferndale, Fortuna, we're all going to be in violation, and I don't see any way that we can make these permits work with the amount of rainfall we get, the shortage of land, and the severity of what we're talking to remove here. I mean, Lindane, you can drink Lindane and water up to, 68 parts per trillion, and we have to move it to 19, and right now we're at 92. If people just don't voluntarily stop using this stuff, but, if you look at some of this stuff, bisphthalate, it's liquid soap, detergents, decorative inks, lacquers, lubricating oils, rubbing alcohol, insect repellents. You start looking where stuff come from. Lindane, it's used in prescriptions to get rid of head lice in seniors and children. DDT. I mean, I thought they stopped making DDT 40 years ago. They don't. They still prescribe it in medication. They still use it primarily for scabies and body lice. I was shocked when he gave me this Malathion solution he just got prescribed to him last week. And that stuff's going right down the drain. Of course, then you have all the typical things with, you have chloroform and bromochloroform and, all that, the halogenated, methanes. So, I mean, we look at this permit and we're shocked. We're stunned. Honestly, we've spent for 2 months now just in really, how are we going to meet this permit? How can we possibly meet this in any way that's affordable? So, I mean, we'll do the best we can. But I just feel compelled to tell this board that what you're asking for us to do is we consider it almost an impossibility. I mean, we see it's going to bankrupt some of our businesses. We take the average thing that's sold on the store shelf and it's telling us don't let them put people down the drain. People's mentality is, they just dispose of things in wastewater, and this is going to be including a whole shift of the public attitude about if it says don't, tit it on your skin or, don't breathe it, then don't put it down the drain. But just ordinary solvents, all ordinary hand cleaners, cosmetics have agents in there that will put us in violation. And, and we just don't know how we're going to be able to contend with this. But, I mean, we'll do the best we can. We've started a public education process. We're going to have to beef up our ordinances, threaten to fine people and shut off their service if they don't comply. But, the test for this SOS 6 agents is $1,100 a test. We're already starting that cycle now. We have to do random tests all about our system. We have to test businesses. Presumably we'll have to absorb those costs, I think the $120,000 for testing is that's probably a starting point. So we see this as extremely difficult and very, very expensive. And So anyway, I appreciate the opportunity to, I understand that, that we're all here to protect the environment. But, a couple solutions for it is one of that we have to get out of this concept of where this in-pipe testing. We know that we go to the Mad River in the wintertime, and we go at 1 to 100 dilution with a minimum 200 CFS. There's times that river's running at 600 to 800, typically 600 to 800 to 1,000 dilution we're at. And yet we have an in-pipe testing. There's no dilution credit. There's got to be a mixing zone allowance somewhere. You get 2 inches from that pipe, and you've already diluted 1,000 times. It just seems unrealistic, that we're doing an in-pipe test. We know that 2 inches from that pipe is going to have, 1,000 times dilution. But yet we're held to the in-pipe test. And we're going to be required to spend millions and millions of dollars. To me, I think, for a myth. That we're actually accomplishing something here. So, it's discouraging to us. I understand where you're coming from. I understand, that the legislature has written in rules, and every time you ask them, the common sense thing is like the law says, the National Toxic Rule says, EPA says, the legislature says, and it's just like, where is the common sense gone to show some discretion on some of these permits? And I know your hands are locked to some degree. The mandatory minimum penalties, they whack you whether you like it or not, because you're required to do it. But trust me, this will bankrupt businesses. This will drive small communities into bankruptcy. We simply cannot sustain, fees and charges this high. And the engineers are telling us this can't be done. This simply cannot be done. You have agents in there that we can't remove. So the public education process better work, because that's what we're hanging our hat on. Anyway, but I appreciate it. My hat's off to Tom and the staff. They've done a good job. Tom's had a long career. I hope he enjoys the golf course. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Massey.
Before you leave, a couple of questions for you. What is your annual sewer expense now for the district?
We're right around about $1 million now, $1.1 million.
And what does that turn out to be per household, per ESD?
Oh, they're about 18. It's about $18 per service per month.
So we're looking at about 200.
We have about 4,400 services.
Okay, so we're looking at something in the neighborhood of $220-$230 per year per household.
That sounds about right.
Only because I deal with the Forestville system, we are $1,100 per ESD, and we have the same requirements. I understand as a small system, the problem you got, it just, that's, excuse me, the ratepayers in my district would love to have that one, double it.
Well, you have to go also, my median homeowner makes $41,000, non-homeowner makes $21,000, we're at about $31,000 as an average. So, that's, when you start talking, $1,200 a year for sewage costs, that's getting pretty substantial. When you have a lot of seniors, it's going to be tough. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
But if you look at medium household income, you've got to take that into equivalency. So,
Mr. Reed, a question for you. How this is for secondary treatment, correct? Or slightly better than?
The limits for conventional pollutants, BOD and suspended solids, are actually equivalent to secondary. Yeah. They're 45 milligrams per liter as a weekly average and 65 as a monthly average. No, reverse that. 65 is a weekly, 45 is a monthly. So that's less than secondary.
We're at secondary for this permit.
Equivalent to secondary.
Okay, equivalent to secondary. Where are we within the region? How does this sit within the region? And how, I guess what I'm driving at is probably we're going to see higher and greater limits in the future. This permit is good for 5 years. We don't anticipate this going down at the end of 5 years to something less than what we have here.
Well, I would imagine, given the trend that the effluent quality will continue to improve as the wetland system matures. We're seeing effluent limits or effluent concentrations of BOD and suspended solids in the order of 30 milligrams per liter, which is about at secondary level, not equivalent to secondary level.
Okay. But I guess what I'm saying is compared to permits around the region, this is on the low end of requirements, this is on the high end of requirements.
For NPDES permits, it would be a little on the low end. I don't think we have many equivalent to secondary NPDES permit holders.
So I guess what I'm saying is that the future is going to be more restrictive, not less restrictive.
Well, generally, if we for anything less than secondary, we base it on performance. So as performance improves, the limits will go down.
Okay. Another topic, the CRT, the California Toxics, CTR, California Toxics Rule. Can you give us a basic description of CTR?
Well, it is based off of the National Toxics Rule, which is in effect throughout the rest of the country. It went into effect in 2000, so everybody should have had a heads up that these were coming along. This permit renewal just happened to be the first one where these limits were included. They are to regulate 126 priority pollutants that are potentially toxic to aquatic life and human health.
So this isn't just exclusive for McKinleyville?
No. Any NPDES discharger has to comply with, in California, CTR, and anywhere else in the country, the National Toxics Rule, which is very similar.
And in terms of, because I do understand that there are things that are flushed down the drain that we cannot get out, but given the world of a small community such as this, can most of these things be removed?
Well, that remains to be seen. The compliance schedule does focus on source control and public education. So for these contaminants, I think we both agree that that's the best place to focus on. Treatment systems to eliminate these constituents would be costly.
And finally, I guess, because it's not one that I'm fond of, the mandatory minimum things. If the public awareness doesn't work, there would be mandatory minimums for detections on these, correct, or exceedances?
Well, the way that Water Code 13.13.385 works, there are serious violations and there are chronic violations. So it really depends on how much they would exceed the effluent limits. If it's more than 40% greater, then it would be an automatic $3,000 fine. If it's less than 40%, these might be 20% because they're Category 2. 20% for Category 2. So if they're less than 20%, then it will depend on how many other violations they have in a six-month period, whether they'd be fined for them or not. So it's hard to say.
And one final question. Is there any way, given I certainly have a feeling for small communities, is there any way that we can lower this, make this permit less, if you will, from the perspective of the discharger, less onerous?
Well, we've done what we can. The monitoring requirements certainly pose a challenge for the discharger, but they are required to demonstrate compliance with effluent limits and receiving water limits, and we need to have monitoring to be able to assess that. So we've relaxed it as much as we could by removing some monitoring requirements and removing the frequency for total trihalomethanes, for instance. So that should be some cost savings. As far as the recent potential for the priority pollutants, they are what they are, and they showed recent potential, and we can't, by law, not include them in the permit.
Thank you. Mr. Hales?
Yeah, maybe just to build off of what Mr. Massey was asking, and I'm just going to kind of rephrase a question here, or maybe state it another way. We have mandatory minimums if we are in violation for certain constituents that we don't know can be removed or not at this point. Would that be fair to say? So, for example, if there are constituents now that are being listed that we don't know if via treatment they can or cannot be removed, say if they cannot be removed, that's still a mandatory minimum that could be assessed.
For violations, yes.
Correct. Okay. And to build off of that, we have thresholds of 20% or 40% exceedance on some of these, but if some of these particular constituents have exceptionally low concentration thresholds and exceedance on, you know, parts per trillion of 20% or 40%, it really is nothing at that point, realistically speaking. So it wouldn't take much to exceed by 40%. I'm trying to just kind of put this into perspective. So
it wouldn't 20% of a concentration in the parts per trillion is small, but it's still a violation.
I understand. I'm very clear on that. I may be parts per trillion may be a bit exaggerating here for something like that, but I'm.
Well, dioxins are picograms per liter.
Okay.
It's 19 parts per trillion.
Okay. Thanks.
Anyone else? Do we have other speakers? I guess I'm interested, Mr. Reed, in terms of comparing this permit. I mean, the format of the permit's the same. We see it from entity to entity. I'm struck in this one, the priority pollutants is a longer list than I've seen in others.
Well, you might look in your permit package. It's almost identical to Ferndale's, except for trihalomethanes. I don't think we had recent potential here for those. But it's essentially the same list.
And I guess I'm looking for a success story on somewhere else that these have been applied, that we've been able to remove the things we want removed.
I'm not sure that any compliance schedules have been completed yet for other dischargers that may have had these pollutants in there as reach potential.
And there's, in this case, there's the trend line is moving in the right direction, wetlands coming online for the traditional factors. Are we anticipating that that could occur as well on the priority pollutants, or that they're just going to pass through and still be a problem?
Well, we're investigating that right now. I mean, when we built the first slide you saw up there was the plant when it was being constructed in 2000. There was a minor correction. We built 5 acres of wetland treatment wetlands in the treatment plant, and then we had 5 acres of stormwater wetlands we built east of the treatment plant to handle all the stormwater that just runs through our property across town. We only use treated wastewater to keep those plants healthy so they don't die. It's a point right now where we have a pilot study going on with a young firm that wants to try to start processing algae. We're going to remove algae and to see if the algae in fact does pick up some of these priority pollutants. They want to make a business of filtering algae out of the plant and selling it as fertilizer. So we're going to have we're going to test the both the algae and the supernatant to see if either one of them have these priority pollutants, and if so, does it adhere to the algae and thus be removed to some degree? So we're going to be doing that test probably in the next couple of months. We'll find out. The odd thing is we did six of these tests back in 2001 to 2003. The first four were relatively clean. In the fall of 2003, we picked up some of the phthalate and lindane problems, and then in 2004, we got a pretty good slug. And it was those two, so I don't know if they had an outbreak in the schools and they started using things on the kids' head, But the first four samples were fairly clean, and it's those last two that really got us. And because they saw it one time, you know, we wanted to immediately start doing more testing, but said, if it's there one time, it could be then again. You know, our big concern in a way is that, like, we allow these septic tank pumpers come up all over the county. I mean, DDT was very popular and useful. I mean, on the past, I mean, somebody could have a slug of this in their septic tank. They go out, pump a septic tank, hasn't been pumped for 25 or 30 years because the house, you know, the property sells, and all of a sudden it shows up. And you may not see it again for, you know, that, who knows? I mean, these things come from all over Humboldt County and up into Del Norte. You know, Steve's Septic is probably hauls 90% of all the septic in Humboldt County in that region, and it all comes to us. I mean, we don't take the solids. He has a what's called a Simon Moose method. He settles all the solids out, but all the supernatant comes to us, and then he hauls the solids to Nevada. You know, all our trash is being hauled out of Humboldt County to someplace else, Oregon or Redding or Nevada or someplace. We don't process anything there anymore, but we get the water. And, you know, to say, okay, well, can you test the septic pumper? Well, you have to test the right load at the right time at the right house, because it could be one out of 1,000 that he picks up, and all it takes is one. When it goes into that treatment plant of 40 million, it just mixes. It's like when you throw, you know, throw a tablespoonful of, you know, of ink into your fish tank and then keep putting in a cup at a time, how long does it take for that to go away? And that's where we're at. If you dump the whole tank, that's one thing, but you can't dump your whole plant. So it just slowly, you know, dilutes, and it may last for 2 years before it finally dilutes out. We don't know. I mean, we're going to find out, I guess, but, you know. But the engineers are telling us they don't know any way practically to take it. If we can't do it by public education, they don't know of a process to get this stuff out. They're talking $100 a gallon. I mean, that's their estimates. You know, at minimum $100 a gallon. You know, we're talking a $100 million plant. I mean, I don't know anybody in California that's got a plant like that. There's not been one constructed that I know of that can then remove this stuff.
Mr. Reed?
Yeah, let me add something here. We don't know how effective the wetlands treatment will be to removing these constituents. I don't believe that any samples have been analyzed since 2006, so it could be that we won't see them again. It's possible. It would also be worthwhile to point out that, and John Short informed me, since he has a better knowledge of what's happening throughout our region, is that Ferndale and McKinleyville have a slightly longer list of CTR pollutants in as effluent limitations in their permits, but they are unusual in that they have a slightly less level of treatment and maybe a less robust pretreatment and source control program than some of our other discharges like Santa Rosa, who you might expect to see a lot of these exotic contaminants, but you don't generally.
And would you share Mr. Markin's assessment that that's the source is head lice, and this is the where these chemicals are coming from mostly, or where do we have some other theories?
For alpha lindane.
Those are the common sources, at least for lindane. DDT, there might be pesticides used anywhere. They are no longer made in the United States, but that doesn't mean they're not made elsewhere. Lindane and DDT are available outside the country, and you can certainly bring them in. People may have stocks of these in their garage that they could call upon when necessary. But that's why we wanted to focus on public outreach, to let people know the potential impact of just dumping these down the drain, is that you are causing problems at the wastewater plant that you're potentially ultimately going to have to pay for.
And in terms of testing the septic haulers' loads, I mean, I would concur that it seems theoretically possible, but it's virtually impossible to target the source where contamination may have come from. Or do you have some other thoughts on how one might approach that problem?
Well, with a Hopland treatment plant, which you looked at earlier today, we do have a fairly rigorous septic hauler monitoring program. There's load checking involved, and true, you can't. You're not going to analyze every load because it would be very costly. But you can analyze loads every so often, and let the people know who are discharging to your system that you are monitoring it. And if something is picked up, then it'll be looked more closely to find out who might be discharging this. That we hope alone will keep the septage haulers honest and not taking hazardous waste. So what we would recommend here to McKinleyville is that they develop a program with septic treater and to develop a program to look at the quality of this of the water being discharged to McKinleyville treatment plant.
All right, Carol.
Well, I kind of have a technical question. We're looking at a very stringent permit, and yet when I read these are new to me. These are my first time in looking at MPDES permits. But we talk about anti-backsliding and degradation. What happens now if the applicant cannot meet these standards, if they show that they cannot meet these standards, that it's just impossible, or cost-wise, it's just as astronomical, and we have these policies in place. What happens when the next permit comes up?
Do you mean for CTR pollutants or conventional pollutants?
Well, both, and the fact that we have an anti-backsliding policy.
Well, we anticipate for at least conventional pollutants that they'll be able to comply with the permit without much difficulty. And in fact, the quality of the effluent has been improving such that the next permit likely will have slightly lower effluent limits for BOD and suspended solids. For CTR pollutants, if they're unable to comply, the next course would be an enforcement action by the board, where we would recommend, and that would probably entail a cease and desist order that would give them time to figure out how they're going to meet these limits. There's really, we can't not include these limits in the permit. They're based on the California Toxics Rule. They're established according to the protocols in the California Toxics Rule, and to leave them out of the permit or would leave us open to petition from anyone. Did that answer your question?
And if I may ask, Charles, in terms of the testing required, if McKinleyville were 10 times larger, would we ask that this same amount of testing, or is smallness of size a hardship? This is my question.
We usually adjust the frequency of monitoring to the size of the discharger, and
is that a possibility? I mean, I'm just trying to think of maybe possible solutions.
That is a solution. A large issue that board would have to deal with. There are quicker solutions. The discharger can do a water effects ratio translator studies or find site-specific objectives that are more applicable to the Mad River at the discharge point.
Say that last part again.
Site-specific objectives. The CTR establishes water quality objectives or standards for waters of the U.S. And the standards were developed based on toxicity studies that were conducted on very clean water from the Great Lakes area. And when there's water that is not as pure as that, water that has sediment, the potential toxic contaminants tend to adhere to solids and not become available to create a toxic response. So the federal regulations and state implementation plan allow for the discharger to conduct studies to develop site-specific objectives that are different from CTR that account for the local condition of the receiving water, as opposed to water that is pure from the Great Lakes. So there are some avenues for them to have different water quality criteria.
Mr. Noren.
Can I ask, is there now a pre-treatment program or public education, or are you saying that now this is going to be something that's implemented as a part of this permit?
Well, we started a public education process now. I mean, since we're basically a pond plant, that our pretreatment consists. I mean, we go around and do line cleaning. We check with restaurants to make sure they don't put grease and oils. We have waste discharge prohibitions for, you know, they're fairly stringent as far as our district. But we don't have any anaerobic digestion. We don't have digesters. We virtually have facultative ponds that, you know, the sludge stays in the bottom of the ponds. We run it through, you know, essentially macerators, and then, you know, the heavy solids settle out in the first ponds, and then, you know, the others are polishing ponds. And one of our problems is we produce a lot of algae because, you know, everything breaks down to have a lot of ammonia. So when you have 40 acres of open water, you're going to have a lot of algal growth. And a lot of our passes, you have blooms of algae, and it's, you can actually watch BOD climb in ponds 3 and 4 over what it is in pond 1 because the algae blooms and then dies off. And that's part of the marshes to shade the water as well as to remove a lot of the algae out of the water. And that's apparently working pretty well. We've gotten down from the high 90s down to about 23 or 25 now in NFR or TSS, whatever. BOD is coming down more slowly, but we're down in the 30s range from what was in the 50s or 60s. So it's, I mean, the marshes are definitely helping out, but we think it's going to have limited success, for they will help pick up some of the metals, but our copper is at 33 in the winter, and that's an interesting point with copper. Since they've gotten rid of asbestos brake pads, and they don't use asbestos and brake pads and clutch plates, we've watched the incidence of copper climb dramatically, and the reason is they now put brass in clutch plates and brake shoes. It all ends up on the roads or people's driveways and any leaking pipes or washing them through manholes or whatever. And we have, you know, if you look in the summertime, we're about 10 to 11 milligram per liter in the plant. In the wintertime, after 2 or 3 rains, it goes to about 30 to 33. That's just coming off the roads. You know, and our infiltration is not high. We maybe go from 800 to 1.1. I mean, a lot of the communities there are 800, 900, 1,000%. You know, infiltration, we're maybe 20, 25. So we're one of the tightest systems, but we don't know what's going to happen. We, you know, some of these things, you know, we can, you know, correct to some degree. But like the nitrate issue for us, it's not a simple issue. I mean, we have lots of ammonia, and we don't have pretreatment. I mean, even conventional plants don't convert ammonia well. And we have high, we come in about 30 parts per of ammonia.
But again, do you have, as a municipality, developed management practices?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. We have, you know, we have a best management practice. You know, we have an aggressive a program of line cleaning of restaurants. They have to report, you know, when they, you know, that they don't dump grease and oils down. You know, so we're pretty aggressive as pretreatment. But you know, once it gets to the plant, it's pretty much it's a facultative pond system. But you know, we do what we can. I mean, we feel we're probably responsible, but. We're in a peculiar environment there with all the rain, too.
Can I also ask you, from the standpoint of the percolation ponds, you're being asked to do a study on the percolation ponds, which was just briefly mentioned, but what does that mean, the outcome, either way, of that pond study or the percolation bed study? What does that mean to you?
Well, the percolation beds right now are at the very low end of the ranch in the gravel beds adjacent to the river. We release probably 15% of our treated wastewater in those ponds, and when those ponds are most critical to us are particularly in the spring of the year, about from right around the May 15th deadline we have to get out of the river. But if it's been raining, we can't apply irrigation, because our if you notice on the slides, we have a ranch that's about 100 acres. About 40 is on top and about 60 is on the bottom. The stuff on top is fairly high, but then it drops off dramatically, you know, down a slope to the lower portion. That is heavy in silt, and it's only a few feet above the river. We are the lowest point of that slope area. There's all the ranches, all the above us, all drained to that point. So that slide gate you saw is a release gate. We keep that closed so that water doesn't flood back up and flood our pastures in the winter. And then as water begins to build in stormwater, we just release that gate and open it up. But that's closed all summer long. So the problem we have is if we lose those perk basins, which it looks like we probably will. I mean, they're only probably maybe 150 feet from the river. And I think this came out of a lawsuit somewhere down, and that the perk basins affected, you know, to consider that we're an estuary. So we're probably going to still put a monitoring well in to check it with the hopes that we can still use those. Because if we can't use that perk basin for the time period from May 15th to for the next 2 or 3 weeks when it's raining, we're hard-pressed what we're going to do with this water, you know. We can't, if we can't exceed flood irrigation on the top, because that's going to impact nitrate in the groundwater, we'll put it in violation. And we can't irrigate on the bottom pastures because it's already too wet. You can't have ponded water. What are we going to do with 1,000,001 gallons a day coming in? You know, in about 2 weeks, our ponds are going to be overflowing. I've got to get rid of that water somewhere, and that's what that perk basins are for. That's when we heavily use that perk basin, is in the early spring. And if we lose that, we better come up with a plan prior to next spring, because we're going to be in trouble. We'll probably just have to go to the flood paddocks on top and take the fines. We don't have any choice. Either that, we're going to overflow the plant. So, I mean, you know, this nitrate issue is going to hit us August 1, and that's going to be an immediate problem for us. I mean, and believe me, nitrate is not easy to do. Well, in fact, ours is ammonia. We don't have nitrate. We don't have any nitrification in our plant because the alkalinity is all wrong in the plant. We've had a number of engineers look at it, and it's not a simple solution. They talk about nitrox systems, you know, in Europe, and they're horrendously expensive. You know, a facultative pond system has limitations, and we've definitely found out what they are, you know, and most of the systems around us have conventional treatment, so they handle ammonia better. Ours does not. And the way we handle ammonia is we irrigate it to the groundwater, and then it converts by bacteria, Nitrous ammonis and Nitrobacter, in the ground, and, you know, to convert it to nitrite, and then either the plants use it or it's gassed off. But when you put it in heavy amounts, it just washes right through, and which is why we made those paddocks on the top, so that we put those in a 97 so that we could dispose of large amounts of water in the spring of the year, in the fall of the year when the rains start, and we can't go in the river, or before we can go in the river, you know, in the fall. But so we have that late spring, late fall, when we can't go in the river, that we have problems of what to dispose of. And then if we apply agronomic rates on top of that, I mean, we just gone 10 times what we're going to have for our land. So, because we're putting out as much as 500,000 and 600,000 gallons a day on our paddocks on top. Now, we'll be down now to an inch of water. We're putting on as much as 15 inches right now. I mean, just start doing the math and multiplying out what we're going to have. And there's not that much land available. So,
I'd like to point out there's a compliance schedule for an alternative disposal method, and it's on page 23 of the permit, and it gives the discharger until January 2012 just to submit a written proposal, and it'll give up to an additional five years to actually complete the project. So it could be as long as 2017 to come up with an alternative to the percolation pond discharge.
Accrue mandatory minimum fines if we're going to... No. I see no.
Okay. No. I'm told.
Other board member comments, questions? All right. We thank you. And I will just, I've consulted with my legal staff, but we did receive a letter on this item that was deemed late, came in late. It's been included in the packet, and I, for one, read through it. So, I mean, it'll be part of the record, though. Staff did not respond to it, but I just wanted to make that note. That's all.
And Mr. Chair, it's at the board's discretion whether to include it in the record, but because it is in the agenda packet, I think it's probably a foregone conclusion.
Right. In this case, we'll take it. I have a sense that our executive officer has been seeking recognition, but not aggressively. But I will. I may make a chair comment here in terms of a sense that I have. I mean, for me, it's difficult. And I'm interested in seeing if we have our back up against the wall in terms of time. I'm sensitive to the opening comment made by the witness in terms of a lot of technical information, a short amount of time to review it, and, you know, my desire would be to have full understanding, comfort. I mean, you may not ever be happy with the outcome, but at least understand what's contained therein is important to beginning to accept what's in the permit. So I don't know if we have time to. And I would just observe that my sense is the district, though there may be some history here, and we may have had pushing them, and they may not have been up to par in other things. It's my assessment, just never met this man before, but as he appears before us, seems to be willing to try to make things work and not get out from under reasonable requirements. So, you know,
okay, so 30 days. And,
you know, we are limited in what, because of the box created by others and the rules and regulations, laws. But at the same time, I hope we can find some way to make. You know, it does us no good to send out requirements that we know can't be met and go down a path that gets us nowhere, I mean, at the end. So just some comments before giving the executive officer a moment to collect her thoughts before she now speaks to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would emphasize that the pond system on this particular treatment plant is still coming online and is going to give us, I think, very much improving effluent quality. In writing this permit, we've exercised all the flexibility that we think we have to offer, both in terms of the monitoring and reporting program, but also in terms of the compliance schedules. These compliance schedules, there is no way that this board can extend the compliance schedules beyond what is offered. They're at basically the statutory or the regulatory maximum for coming into compliance with the California Toxics Rule. In terms of timing, in all, there were about 45 days worth of public comment, and from my view, I don't see more time working on this permit is going to change the outcome. And because of that, I would urge you to adopt it. I think we need to continue to work with the discharger very closely. I think we believe there are a number of solutions that can be brought to bear, and over the next couple of years, we will be able to solve at least a good majority, if not all, of the problems that have been raised. And that's the purpose of the compliance schedule, is to give us that time between now and then.
And on the compliance schedule, is trying to connect the dots here. We've seen something in the packet we were mailed, and there's also been changes made to that, adaptations responding to the discharger's
right
request.
We initially did not include compliance schedules in the initial permit, and with additional information that was provided by the discharger, we gave them the maximum compliance schedule that we could.
I guess I'm not quite sure that that's sunk in from the discharger standpoint.
I'm just suggesting there really isn't an alternative.
Yeah.
The compliance schedule is hard and fast. It isn't something that we can negotiate or change. All we can do is shorten it. We can't make it longer.
And do we have a set of steps that the compliance schedule, you know, we start in point A and then we do point B and then we follow up on point C, and have we got those? I mean, are you, you're saying that all of them are rung out as far as they can go, and they're all on the same time frame, start immediately, but you've got a block of time, as I hear it, 5 years to complete it, or do we have some where you can start somewhere?
Yeah, May 18th, 2010 is the regulatory deadline. Yep.
And in the, run by me again, staff would, in terms of the steps the discharger needs to go through to, I mean, 2018 is a ways down the road. It's
No, 2010.
May 18th, 2010. I'll enunciate more clearly.
Maybe I could help clarify. I'm John Short, Senior Engineer in the Watershed Protection Division, and I think the time schedules we're talking about now are for the California Toxics Rule pollutants, so the dioxins and lindanes and those pollutants. The maximum time schedule we can allow is 2010, and we are allowing that much time because they did come up with a public education and outreach, a pre-treatment program that we hope between now and 2010 they can eliminate those sources in the community of these toxic pollutants. There are other special studies and other things that can go out longer than 2010, but the toxics, that's what we're held to by the California Toxics Rule.
I'd also like to reiterate that the CTR became effective in 2000. This shouldn't have been a surprise that some of these results are from 2002, so they've had 6 years from now and back to 2002 to start looking at how they're going to comply with these.
Mr. Massey.
It strikes me that things such as DDT and lindane, which are now illegal for purchase in the United States, are nonetheless available in other sources. Are there reasons why someone would buy these things?
I guess for lindane, it was just recently banned. So I think what we're probably seeing is the, you know, it was legal. It's now not on the shelves anymore. I believe this last summer. So people still are going to have some at home, but you're going to see that, like, as DDT from a high, it's going to go down. And it was banned because of problems with treatment plant pass-through and failure of toxicity tests. So we're hopeful that that ban will bring, you know, with a replacement kind of for head lice, we won't be seeing lindane in another couple of years in effluent.
So we hope that's one of the public education processes, is to educate the community that if they have any of this material, they should take it to the household hazardous waste collection receptacle and then use these alternative
right.
products instead of continuing to use these products that are now banned. There are substitutes out there. So that's one of the tasks between now and 2010 that we hope can eliminate lindane as being a pollutant of concern.
I guess the point that I'm looking at is that if these things have some kind of incentivization because they work better than anything else or because they work and nothing else does, then I think we're, and we are not a legislative body. We don't have the ability to do that, and I understand that, but it does not stop us from understanding the problem and the parameters of it. If there is something about these things that is not possible to get in another product, then it's a problem that we're going to face in the future. That's just something that's there, and it's probably something that we need to take up with things like the water quality coordinating committees in terms of how we respond to them, because this just isn't, if there's an incentive to use these products, then we're going to be hard pressed. We're simply going to be dealing with them. That's all there is. Thank you.
And if staff would, again, have we run into Lindane in any other community and been successful in having it addressed?
The city of Santa Rosa was the only other treatment plant that I'm aware of that did have a hit of Lindane several years ago. They do have an active pretreatment program, and between that and retesting over time, they've never seen another hit of that particular pollutant. So I think the ban and outreach has worked in Santa Rosa. I'm not aware of any other communities that have had hits of Lindane.
And the pretreatment, what activity, what do they do?
They have a pretty aggressive education and outreach program to educate the community. They do support, in conjunction with the county, household hazardous waste collection. So all those efforts sort of combine to tell folks that, you know, there are replacement products and they shouldn't be using this particular product any longer.
All right. Board member comments?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Massey?
It strikes me that, as Mr. Reed has pointed out, that this is, I believe, one of the first permits that we will see like this, but this is obviously not the last.
Actually, this is one of the last that will have the CTR limits. Everybody else has passed through the first screen. I think this is either the last or just about the last that will have the first round of CTR chemicals in them.
Okay, but there will be further escalation of the CTR.
There isn't any planned at this point in time. I think the issue in front of the wastewater world right now is what to do about pharmaceuticals, nanoparticles, and new chemicals, emerging chemicals. But there isn't, EPA hasn't been putting out any new criteria, nor are they under court order to do so, nor is it slotted to do any new regulatory action slotted to be done by the State Water Board. Nor is it on our triennial review. So I think we can forecast that things, of course, will change as our world changes. But I would just say, for the immediate future, I can't. There's nothing that's right out in front of us.
So what you're saying is that makes it a little bit different. We are not going someplace in the future. This is simply bringing one or two systems up to the level that everybody else is. Thank you.
It's perhaps worthwhile to point out that we do this reasonable potential analysis in advance of every permit renewal. So we'll look back through the previous 5 or so years' data, and if there are any other new constituents that show reasonable potential, they'll get an effluent limit. If we don't detect those pollutants that had previously had reasonable potential, then that would be rationale for not including that in the next permit go-around.
And how many, what's it take to fall off the list? I mean, just if it's not there the next time you test it, then it falls off, or it has to be not there 3 times before it falls off? Or?
Well, the only way we would fall off is if the permit's revised or renewed, and that wouldn't happen for another 5 years unless it's opened for cause.
Charles, you might want to mention that what is going on in the next 5 years for monitoring that will feed into the next permit?
McKinleyville is required to monitor their effluent annually for the whole suite of CTR pollutants. For those pollutants that have reasonable potential, they need to do that monthly. So by the end of, they need to submit a new report of waste discharge 6 months before the next permit, for this permit would expire. So we would get quite a lot of data by that time, and we would use that for the next reasonable potential analysis.
I want to raise one, maybe two additional items. One is the monitoring location. We've had that discussion in this room before, and it was my sense that we concluded that it was possible to monitor. I mean, I've heard that same in pipe versus somewhere outside of the end of, end of the pipe, and I'm curious as to if the requirement here is in pipe versus somewhere close to the release point.
I believe Mr. Marking was talking about the toxic limits, which are effluent limits. They are measured at the end of the pipe unless he chooses to go through the mixing zone analysis. Receiving water stations in this case are not at the end of pipe. Mr. Reed is going to show us that.
The upstream monitoring location is at the at the Mad River where the Highway 101 crosses. The downstream location, I believe in the permit it says has to be anywhere downstream of the discharge. Currently, I believe it's done, I believe this is a boat launch. I think that's where they currently do it. Right there? Thank you. I've corrected. That's the downstream monitoring point at currently for the discharge that occurs at the bridge.
And are, is there other monitoring that's in pipe then? Or the, I mean that, I was just stuck on his phrase, in pipe.
Into pipe.
Not end, but in.
I think he's referring to end of pipe. That's done at the treatment plant, actually. It's not for water quality objectives. I believe the sample is collected here, but it's collected near the, oops, I'm looking at, not looking at the, so right in there. That's where the disinfection takes place, and the compliance point is at 001 for effluent limitations.
And a mixing zone wouldn't change that then.
Well, the mixing zone would allow us to account for that dilution in the effluent limit itself. It would go into the calculation. It would raise the water quality objective, and therefore there might not be reasonable potential. One of the ways we calculate effluent limits is we look at the water quality objective, and then we at that point, we would account for dilution if it's available, a mixing zone if it's available. We don't have that ability to do in our region, so we so the water quality objective is essentially becomes the effluent limit. If there were a mixing zone or a dilution credit available, the limit would be higher.
So in the operation of this facility, it, the compliance zone what the water passing through the compliance zone goes through each of those ponds before it would be discharged in all cases?
Yes. The wastewater goes through all treatment components here before discharge.
And in some cases it would go through the wetlands, but not in all cases?
I believe it would always go through...
Always go through the wetlands?
Well, technically it would be a bypass if it doesn't go through all treatment components.
And I'm not clear in my own head in terms of then the compliance requirements occur at that point of 1A. That's what has to be met, and we're not accounting for...
Well, this pond 1A is the first pond, so the influent comes into here. It goes through this way, right. And then it comes through here, and there's a it's disinfected at this point, and also there's a composite sampler to collect samples. That is what I mean by the pipe down here, and that's where the compliance point is.
Hold up one second. I want you to come forward and be on the tape.
I would note that the compliance point of where the sample is taken would be basically the same as where it is for Santa Rosa. It's the same idea. So it's just because we were just there, and so you know we were looking at where they after they ran it through the disinfection. That's where they sample for compliance, essentially.
Laser. Okay. I think it might be helpful. We virtually when the piping first comes in, there's a head works right there. It splits the flow to either pond, and then it flows through the process of the ponds back out through pond 5, and then it runs through a pipe underground to the chlorine contact chamber where it's chlorinated, disinfected, and then dechlorinated. At that point, we take a sample with a composite sampler prior to being released to a pipe that goes out and all the way down and then out to the Mad River. So that's why the monitoring, the collection point is right at that spot. It's the very end of the plant. When I say in pipe, I'm referring to
right.
At that point rather than, say, 1 foot in the river from the pipe.
Right. I hate to run you back up here, Mr. Markin, but I'm going to. In terms of just your, I mean, you began your presentation noting, as you heard me say, sensitive to your concerns about lack of time, lack of opportunity to delve into it, yet at the same time there have been changes made, and I guess just at this point in the discussion, are you more comfortable where things stand and your understanding of things the way they stand, or are you still, you know, appreciate that there are lots of new tests, new requirements, and you may not have drilled down to find out the full impact of all of those, but at the same time, you've had it in front of you for some time.
I think we understand the impacts, and that's what worries us. That some of the things that are unknown to us are the trigger points. When we start turning in some of these studies, what's the next step that's going to follow after this? There's some immediate concerns, the ammonia in the water. That is not easy for us. We have to meet that by August 1. We're hard-pressed to figure how we're going to do. I mean, we're going to have to really get some creative solutions on how to take care of that problem. By next winter, we're going to have to certainly look at our irrigation patterns on how we're going to stay in compliance. We'll study the perk ponds for a while, but you know the engineers that tell us don't waste your money on it. It's probably not going to pan out anyway. Well, then we better have a plan B right away for how we're going to dispose of this water. This kind of puts us right up against the wall. But I agree with one thing. I don't know that more time at this is probably going to make any difference. I mean, we crammed this thing in pretty tough for about 3 weeks to get this, and I think we understand what's there now. I just want the board to understand. I've asked the question a number of times. What other community has these constituents and has been able to remove them? And to date, no one can tell me of anyone that's done it. And they say, "Well, Ferndale's the same as ours." But I talked to
And they said they didn't have the DDT, they didn't have the lindane. I mean, they had some things like the bromoform, and that's just, you can't use chlorine. Those are, you know, chlorinated halogenics. I understand that. But when you start getting into the DDT stuff, and by the way, DDT still is made. It's just as exported. It can be used by the public health department. It is used by the military. I mean, these products are still made in this country and still used in this country, just under strict regulation. So there's the misconception, we don't make this. Yes, we do. We just export most of it. So, and then it comes back as a product to us. But, I mean, why our little community has it and nobody else does, I don't know. You know, I mean, we use chlorine in the plant, and because of chlorine, you're going to have, halogenated methanes, that bromoform, chloroform, those things, we're going to have to get away from chlorine, I guess, and go to ozone or also UV or something. So, I mean, those are technical fixes that can be done, but none of them are expensive. So, and if we're the last one in the list, I guess, I know we did tests in 2001 to 4, but we've been asking questions, because a lot of these potential analyses are mathematically driven. And you have to understand that there's an inverse relationship, and it gets a little technical. When the hardness of the river changes, it affects an inverse relationship to metal. So if you come in at a 70 hardness, then you can have 10 milligrams per liter of copper. If you come in at 30, you have to be at 4.2. If you come in at 20, you're probably down to 1.5. So what's the worst we can... This depends on when you take your test. We start taking tests routinely now. I'm sure we're going to find hardnesses where wider ranges, and we'll be held to whatever standard at the lowest one is, that's what we're going to have to meet. So, I mean, it's not like you have to meet a 10 milligram per liter. You have to meet whatever the hardness level on a calculated basis is. That's why these are all moving targets on these potential analysis. It's not, okay, meet 10 milligrams per liter. It may be 10 one time. It might be 3 the next. It might be 1.5. It might be 15. It depends on each sample, the hardness in the river. So, and that's why it's hard to devise technology when you don't have an endpoint. It's shifting all the time, and I mean, it's driven by process, and the staff is doing as much as they can. I appreciate the fact they've done as much as they can for us, but in spite of that, this is not going to be easy, and it's not going to be cheap. And maybe we're one of the ones that, the unfortunate ones that had DDT and lindane, and nobody else has this. I'm happy for them that they don't have it, but.
I would note that lindane was a big problem in LA, which are now on their second CTR issued permits, and that finding it the first time is what drove the ban, and so they have in fact removed it from their treatment systems, Santa Rosa as well. So I think, again, some of these chemicals, I'm thinking also with DDT, some communities have gotten rid of the DDT by, dredging their ponds or by cleaning their lines, which it had collected in over time, and by cleaning them out, it got rid of the problem. All of these chemicals are a problem in the environment. It's not as if we're making up the limits. These are well-studied chemicals. Some of these are very extremely bioaccumulative, going into a very sensitive water body. And so I think we shouldn't be losing track of that either, that we need to get, in my judgment, is we need to move forward with this permit, helping the district, make sure that they've got all the flexibility that we can afford to give them, but we need to move ahead with this and get on with it.
Mr. Hales.
Yeah, Mr. Marking, to get to the question, sort of the bigger question that you're asking, if no other CSDs have lindane or DDT, locally, Lolita, Ferndale, they're not, land use and industry isn't any different than McKinleyville. The communities are roughly the same. It seems that, from what you had said earlier, that you're the only district that's accepting supernatant from septic tanks. And so does that just seem like an obvious trigger for you that this is where it's coming from? If we're, if McKinleyville's doing nothing different than any of the others, then it seems, to me, it sounds like a fairly likely culprit. And then,
well, except that lindane, the only it's really general use for it is it's treated in seed. It's used heavily in agriculture to treat seed. The other use of that alpha lindane is used for head lice. And, I mean, there's no question that our schools every year have a surge of, head lice problems. Kids come out of the backcountry, and do we get it? It's possible.
I don't know, maybe we took the wrong sample the wrong month, you know? We took the wrong month. It's the other plants, they don't have ponds like we do. They have conventional plants that they don't have storage for 40, 50 days like we do. They process in and out. That's the problem. We have a 40-day cycle because we have 40 million gallons. So when it gets there, it stays there a long time. Whereas if it was a one day, if you hit that one day, you get it. The next day, it would be gone. So, you know, maybe in this case, the ponds is playing against us right here.
Somebody gets to go out to lunch with their...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like, why us? Why are we the lucky ones?
All right, thank you. And if, Charles, just stay there 1 second. I can't help myself. I just page F-35. My apology, I didn't get to you beforehand, but paragraph E, other monitoring requirements. Are you with me?
Yes.
All right. First line, visual observations are required at monitoring locations M001 through M009. And when I go try to track where M009, I don't find it anywhere. So if you go to page E-2, I think.
I would say it needs to be M008.
008, yes. We don't want these things coming back, you know. Okay, we've had a thorough discussion. I'm open to suggestions. Mr. Massey?
I would agree with you, Mr. Chair. We've had a very thorough discussion. I would also agree with the executive officer, particularly if we have gone as far as we can in terms of allowing latitude for small districts to which I have a particular affinity, but under the circumstances, I would give you a motion to adopt this NPDES permit R1-2008-0039.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Discussion?
Labor revisions.
Any staff comment?
And the motion should be amended to include the late revisions.
As amended. All right. Do we have before us a motion as amended? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. All right. I'm inclined to take a short break.
Good.
For the good of the board. Oh, if I may, I just want to pass along one comment from the chair of the State Water Board during the chair's conference call this past month. She expressed understanding for the difficulties that small communities are having in this regard, and it wasn't specific to this item. It's one, this board's had discussions in Sacramento, you know, the difficulties of small communities trying to meet these requirements and the financial burden that imposes. So just, you know, there's some understanding at the top level. I don't know that there'll be money, but that's, you know, Fred will bring that. Thank you. Board is back in session. Take up item 10.